Thank you very much, Akhil, for an extremely sober and thoughtful talk. Our next speaker is Dr. Tony Judd, director of the Remark Institute at New York University, a regular writer in the New York Review of Books, and a very courageous defender of his own position on Israel-Palestine, which has not often won him bouquets, but in fact brickbats have been showered on his head many a time. So we're very, very privileged to have him here with us, Tony Judd.
Thank you very much. For reasons that I'm going, I hope, to make clear, I don't think there's anything particularly courageous about what I've done, but thank you for it anyway. I'm a tenured professor at a university. It's a peculiarly privileged and advantageous position to find yourself in, and it's exactly for those reasons that it confers upon you certain kinds of duties. Because you can speak out, you should. I don't want to go over the ground that's already been spoken about, although I second everything that's been said, and particularly with reference to Norman Finkelstein, who, of course, is, as we know, was not a tenured professor, and for whom the act of speaking out, both through his work and in public, took very significant courage and elicited a very significant price. I want to talk first about the question of academic freedom in this country. It seems to me more important today than it used to be, for reasons some of which have been mentioned already, but for one which may not have been mentioned, and that is that in this country as in Western Europe, from the 1880s until the last decades of the 20th century, we lived in a peculiar period of mass literacy and a mass print media, which made possible something which didn't exist before and is dying now, and that is the world of public intellectual debate and written dissent disseminated to a large literate audience through newspapers, magazines, journals, and so forth. Most of the writers and polemicists and others who contributed dissenting views to such journals and magazines were not academics. They were not professors. They were not tenured. Their security in some cases arose from having a private income, in other cases from the successful sale of their books, and otherwise just from the fact that they could publish their views in journals and magazines which would support them in some measure while they did so. We are moving out of that era. There are very few public intellectuals today, I would hazard, who have the kind of private income which allows them to say what they think and be damned. And there are even fewer journals, magazines, newspapers, and print outlets in which they could say it. Can say it. Anyone who followed the non-debate over the run-up to the Iraq war in this country will know what I'm talking about. So the university becomes a much more important place than it was in that century as the space in which you can say unpopular things, in which you can say dissenting things, and therefore the duty of the university to protect people who say those things is much more sharply delineated, much more serious today than it would have been 30, 40, 50, 80 years ago. I don't want to talk too much about my own experience here, but I'm going to give two examples of it to illustrate a point I want to make about the nature of university cowardice in our time. There are many instances all across the country, University of Montana fairly recently, University of Michigan with respect to their relations with Pluto Press, and others across the country of academic institutions avoiding backing down from responding badly to or failing to respond to instances of censorship and so on in the arena of dissenting speech, particularly about the Middle East. My own experience, I can reduce to two examples, two cases. One was when I was invited to give a talk, as it happened, on the place of the Holocaust in European public memory at a small Catholic college near New York, and was advised shortly before I was due to give the talk that I should not make any reference to Israel in the course of the talk, given the notoriety of my views on the subject. So I said, you mean not only may I not speak about Israel, which you've not invited me to and I'm not going to, but I should not actually use the word, lest it come across in a pejorative context. And my host wrote back and said, I'm afraid that's right. So I declined the opportunity to visit the campus. The second instance is more serious. That was a Catholic campus, which had an annual Holocaust lecture, but had been pressured by representatives or self-styled representatives of the local Jewish community to disinvite me and to try to come up with a compromise of inviting me under the conditions I've just given you. The second case was a small liberal arts college in Pennsylvania, no more details than that for reasons which will become clear, when I was invited again to give a lecture on Europe and had to be disinvited by the young person in, as it happened, the Department of Jewish Studies, who had invited me because he had been told that were I to come and he to be the inviter, the president of the university would be under very strong pressure not to tenure him when the time came because of his association with the kind of people he invites, and given the fragility of his position, would I perhaps be willing not to come? And could we agree that I had chosen not to come rather than being disinvited? And of course, we agreed. So, universities are very vulnerable, that's clear. The fact that their administrators are, on the whole, unable to stand up to pressure shouldn't blind us to the fact that there is pressure. Public universities are subject to political pressure, private universities, on the whole, to pressure from donors or implicit pressure with relationship to cash, the giving or withholding of it. But what worries me more than the kind of censorship that we talk about, in this country at least, it's different in some other countries, is self-censorship, the self-censorship which ensues. Why should people go to the trouble of getting in trouble, rendering their career, putting their careers at risk and so on, for a marginal subject as it might be, or for a marginal issue as it might be, when they can simply not talk about it or prophylactically censor themselves by saying a whole series of things which will show the side that they're on before then going on to do one small courageous thing, as it might be. And in a sense, of course, what Lee Bollinger was doing at Columbia was an extended exercise in active prophylactic self-censorship via a public insult. The risk of self-censorship, it seems to me, is much greater in America than the risk of censorship. This is a very conformist society. We know this in our own experience. We know it if we read Tocqueville, who already observed the point in the 1830s. It's a society in which people are extremely proud of being individualists and extremely reluctant to break with whatever the common sense, common opinion might be on a given topic, particularly if it's a sensitive one. And that, of course, brings me to the Middle East. The Israel lobby, and I'm not going to talk too much about it because I imagine John Mearsheimer will, and he's much better qualified to, but the Israel lobby is a very distinctive lobby, and this is perhaps worth emphasizing. Whenever someone says to you, oh, of course there's an Israel lobby, but then there's a gun lobby, there's an oil lobby, there's a Detroit lobby, there's a corn lobby, so what? They're all pernicious in their way, but it's no different. Remember this, that all lobbies seek to get what they want, but only the Israel lobby has a second agenda, or if you like, a second and a third agenda. The second agenda is to deny its own existence, and the third agenda is to ensure silence when it comes to discussing the subject of its lobbying. That's not true in the case of the gun lobby or the oil lobby. If people like us marginal left liberal academics in universities stand up and make a very loud noise about the oil lobby or a very loud noise about the gun lobby. They couldn't care less. The only thing that matters to them is they actually get what they want in the Washington lobbying for which they exist. The Israel lobby cares a lot, and that makes it a very different kind of lobby. It's a lobby which exists in part to silence as well as to voice, to suppress as well as to secure a particular goal. And it operates, of course, through a particularly unpleasant moral leverage, the moral leverage which comes out of being able to accuse someone of anti-Semitism or anti-Jewishness or whatever it might be, in a world which for the last 25 years at least, but not more than that, and maybe not much more in the future, has been particularly sensitive to the destruction of the European Jews as the moral measure, the measure of evil in our collective past, so that any hint that you're insensitive to that disqualifies any other thoughts you might have about the world. So if you can label someone anti-Semitic, you've probably successfully avoided having to engage their argument. There's a new term of art which is also invoked. I've been called on a number of occasions, and I see that some other people around here have as well, an Israel denier. Now, an Israel denier is not quite a Holocaust denier, which is what Norman Finkelstein has on occasion been called, but it enables you by suggestion to be classed with them. Someone who is critical of Israel beyond a certain point is an Israel denier. They deny, that is, that Israel it has the moral right to do as it does and demand the support that it does and so on. And the next thing after an Israel denier is a Holocaust denier. This is an element of moral and semantic leverage which no other pressure group, no other lobby, no other interest group is either able or probably in most cases willing, perhaps the abortion lobby on occasion, to invoke. And it's done in many different ways. It's not only in universities. Publishers are very vulnerable to it. I received, shortly after a public event I was involved in, a letter from a very well-known New York publisher in which she sent me a copy of a letter she'd received from Mr. Abraham Foxman, the director of the Anti-Defamation League, a few years ago. Not discouraging her from publishing a book, pointing out to her that one of the authors in a collection that she was publishing was Mr. Norman Finkelstein, and did she know what a discreditable person he was? And perhaps, in the light of this knowledge, which she might not have had, she would reconsider publishing this book. She, of course, wrote back and told him to go to hell. But that's not what everyone does. When Carmen Khalil, the British publisher, was due to have a book event, a big book event in Manhattan, on the occasion of Knopf's publication of her book about Vichy France, it was cancelled at the last minute because of a very similar pressure brought to bear with reference to a throwaway line in her epilogue, where she pointed out that some of the things that we most hold against Vichy are things exactly that Israel does to the Palestinians, and she gave chapter and verse. And for this, the party was cancelled. The methods of going behind the scenes, hinting, informing, suggesting are one. Accusations of anti-Semitism are another. The third, of course, is the famous demand for balance that Professor Bilgrami has already spoken about. I can give you an instance of how ridiculous this can get. In 2003, when the Iraq War began, I convened a large public meeting at New York University to discuss the US and the Middle East, and one of my guests on the panel was Edward Said. And there were other guests, including Jews, Palestinians, Israelis, and so on. And the provost of my university called me up the day before and said, we've received some communications suggesting that you're holding a very unbalanced meeting on this subject, and we've no intention of interfering with you, and the university never has, but we wondered what you think we should say to them. They say you've got Edward Said and no one to speak against him. And I said, well, why don't you tell them that not only do we have Edward Said, indeed, and Columbia University has him, so why shouldn't NYU? But we also have Shlomo Ben-Ami sitting on the same platform, former foreign minister of Israel, the man who was Israel's negotiator at Camp David and Tabah. Provost passed this along. A little later that evening, called me back and said, they're not happy, he's the wrong kind of Israeli. So there's balance, and there's balance. The response to people who speak about the Israel lobby or the Middle East in this country is strikingly disingenuous, as you must have seen when reading the reviews of John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt's book. And it normally follows a certain pattern. People say, look, I mean, many years ago people used to say, there is no Israel lobby, there's nothing to talk about here. More recently they would say, well, there's an Israel lobby, yes, but it's not that bad, it's not such a big deal. Most recently, they will say, as some of the reviews have said, yes, there's an Israel lobby, yes, it's quite a big deal, but we've been talking about that for years. So why on earth are you making such a fuss about it? And we need to be able to turn around and say, you've not been talking about this for years, and we're making a fuss about it because it has effectively silenced public discussion in this country on a major policy issue. And not only that, but it's been silenced in a way which has discredited, for what it's worth, in a younger generation, and I see this when I go around talking in high schools, which has discredited for a younger generation reference to the Holocaust. On a number of occasions, and not only in this country, but in Western Europe as well, students have said to me, look, all this stuff about the Holocaust, these compulsory courses we have to take, isn't this really just part of the defense of Israel? Isn't this just propaganda? Isn't it exaggerated? Why aren't we getting courses on the Armenians? Why aren't we getting courses on Rwanda and so on? So to the extent that there's any honesty at all in the claim on the part of our critics that we are arousing anti-Semitism, they should know that what they are suppressing in this conversation is the kind of openness which would make it possible for me one to respond honestly to such students and say there is a difference between anti-Semitism and criticizing Israel. There is a difference between anti-Semitism and pointing out what is done to the Palestinians. And if we can't tell that difference, if we're not allowed to speak that difference and therefore can't understand it, we're going to end up with the real anti-Semitism once again, among other things. One final point. Universities don't exist. Hard though it is for some of us to accept it, but they don't exist just for the purpose of protecting dissenting speech, or indeed for the purpose of protecting the freedom of speech. It seems to me that universities in this sense are rather analogous to medieval Christian churches. They exist for the reasons they exist, but they have a side benefit which is enormously important. The benefit of clergy, as it was in late medieval Europe, and protection of freedom of speech as it is today. That is to say that they are places in which members of them can say things that become increasingly difficult to say outside of them. And that places a huge responsibility both on the university and on the people doing the talking inside them. I don't think the situation is going to change in this country. I think it's going to get steadily worse, because whoever comes to power will inherit in the next presidential cycle, and no doubt the one after, the culture of self-censorship and what you might call the politics of fear, the sort of moral blackmail which doesn't overthrow a republic, which doesn't turn a republic into an empire, but steadily corrodes and undermines the kind of public conversation without which a republic is pointless. And in particular, and on this I'll close, we need to understand something. If you stand up here and say, as I'm saying and someone else will probably say as well, that there is an Israel lobby, that there are a set of Jewish organizations who do work, both in front of the scenes and behind the scenes, to prevent certain kinds of conversations, certain kinds of criticism, and so on, you are coming very close to saying that there is a de facto conspiracy, or if you like, plot, or collaboration to prevent public policy moving in a certain way, or to push it in a certain way. And that sounds an awful lot like, you know, the protocols of the Elders of Zion and the conspiratorial theory of the Zionist occupation government and so on. Well, if it sounds like it, it's unfortunate, but that's just how it is. We cannot calibrate the truths that we're willing to speak, if we think they're true, according to the idiocies of people who happen to agree with us for their reasons. It may well be true. I know this because I've received an email from him that David Duke thinks he has found allies in John Mearsheimer or Stephen Walt or myself. But I remind you what Arthur Koestler said in Carnegie Hall in 1948 when he was asked, "Why do you criticize Stalin? Don't you know that there are people in this country, Nixon and what were not yet called McCarthyites, who also are anti-communist and will use your anti-communism to their advantage?" And Koestler's response was the response that I think we should keep in mind when we are faced with the charge that we're giving hostages to crazy anti-Semites or whatever. And that is, you can't help other people agreeing with you for their reasons. You can't help it if idiots, once every 24 hours with their stopped political clock, are on the same time as you. You have to say what you know to be true and be willing to defend it on your grounds, and then accept the fact that people in bad faith will accuse you of having defended it or assigned you, aligned yourself with the others on their grounds. That's what freedom of speech means. It's very uncomfortable. It puts you in bed sometimes with the wrong people. You just have to carry on. And it's a lot easier to do it in universities. And in fact, there is nowhere else we can do it. That's why academic freedom matters.